and so we can get through as much as possible. Basically, what we have is just a panel of BYU students and former BYU students and people who just graduated this morning, which is why we had to move it. We had people who are graduating this morning who have been involved somehow in the events that have taken place at BYU in the last few months. And although we certainly don't represent the entire student body of BYU, in fact, we probably represent a minority, I think we're I think we're all pretty nice people, and so we're not like, I think we're nice people and good students, and so I think we represent a portion of the student body that that if we are unhappy, I think BYU should have some cause to consider what's happening. And to reconsider the kind of things that are going on. Also, I see in the audience there are a lot of BYU students who will be able to participate in the discussion afterward, probably people who have differing points of opinion from ours, and we should be able to have quite a healthy discussion. What we'll do first, I think each one of us will speak for about 7 minutes, and then we'll open it up to a panel discussion with question-answer format. And it was originally scheduled for an hour and a half, and now we're cut down to an hour, so we might be pressed for time. But on the panel today, my name's Brian Waterman, and I'll talk first, and I'll kind of try to moderate the discussion. I'll run around with the microphone like Oprah Winfrey and let people ask questions and things. And Joanna Brooks, who prepared a paper that will be read today, is not here. Her parents bought plane tickets for last week, thinking that's when the symposium was going to be, and they bought tickets this week for Jamaica, and so she called and said she would be going to Jamaica, and she would fax her paper to us. So she's not here. She's not here, unfortunately, but Jamie Harker, who recently took a master's in English at BYU, will read her paper and participate in the discussion following. Next to her is Farrell Lines, who you can tell from the length of his hair, it's longer enough than mine that you can tell he doesn't go to BYU anymore. So he left a couple years ago and went to Columbia to finish his undergraduate work. So he'll be able to compare his BYU experience with an Ivy League experience. Next to Farrell is Missy Vastanet, who's working on a master's in English at BYU. And next to her is Dinah Kirkham, who graduated with a philosophy and English undergraduate and is now pursuing a master's in English at BYU. Oh, that's right. She graduated this morning. That's one of the people we're waiting for. So, and she also has a master's in education from Harvard, I believe. Correct? Yeah. So without anything more, we'll launch into this and get it underway. I've chosen to take a specific angle on this topic. One of the things that I've heard mentioned a lot from BYU administrators and in the correspondence that I've seen Xeroxes of floating around the BYU Rex Lee and Bruce Hafen seem to have a real concern for the testimony of BYU students and for the faith of BYU students, and they feel a need to protect our faith and to keep us from being exposed to things that might violate that faith and would thereby fail in their stewardships over us. So I've chosen today to kind of talk about the topic of faith. And I called the things that I wrote down, if I can remember it, I called it "No faith in students' faith leads to no faith in the house of faith," and which I think a lot of us have experienced. My first exposure to this idea that they needed to protect our faith came when I became aware that Provost Bruce Hafen in, I believe, March of this year, actually earlier, in February of this year, sent a letter to Cecilia Conchar-Farr in which he severely chastised her for her participation in a National Organization of Women conference, and criticized her public stance, her public pro-choice stance. And from what I heard of the letter, I was disturbed enough that, and I had been disturbed earlier in the year by some comments he made to the faculty about David Knowlton without naming him, and I was familiar with both of these professors. I knew them both and counted them both as friends and mentors, and I was disturbed and to write Brother Hafen a letter. And I think I had more faith in the administration at that point, that maybe if they really heard from someone like me who needed professors like this, that it might affect their opinion, or maybe would affect decisions in the future, because I knew that both of us at that point were involved in the third year process. Part of my letter to Bruce Hafen reads as follows. On my mission in New Jersey, I followed a year working in inner cities with 6 months in Princeton. My months working primarily with African Americans had created quite a disturbance for my previously untried faith. The majority of the missionaries I worked with maintained an extremely racist theology, supported by the Book of Mormon to some degree, but fueled for the most part by Bruce R. McConkie and Alvin Dyer. The racist theology had had an incredible negative impact on the missionary work. As one of my roommates on my mission explained, of the three kinds of people in the world, celestial, terrestrial, and telestial, or Jews, Gentiles, and niggers, the latter were of the least intelligence. Since our investigators were primarily African-American, they were hardly worth teaching, since they were cursed by God and of little intellectual capacity. When I challenged his theology, he pulled Dyer and McConkie from his Franklin planner, and how could I refute the Lord's anointed? During my 6 months in Princeton, I researched this issue every day in the Firestone Library, every P-Day in the Firestone Library. And unfortunately, I found that many earlier leaders had held even more offensive notions, Brigham Young in particular. This revelation caused my previous paradigms to shatter. I considered this experience to be analogous with the transition from ignorance and bubble-popping stages in your Love Is Not Blind essay, which I had read. Bruce Hafen's essay, and it had a serious impact on me in a positive way, so I felt slightly betrayed by what he was doing. I was less concerned with popping people's bubbles than with salvaging my own testimony. In the Princeton ward were a number of people whose synthesis of intellect and testimony I respected. One of them, after I had explained my dilemma to her, slipped me a copy of a recent Sunstone after church one Sunday. The cover article, Eugene England's All Are Alike Unto God, provided me with the testimony of a person who also could not accept the church's popular racist traditions. More significantly, though, the author was clear about his testimony of the restored gospel. His article was the impetus I needed to seek reconciliation with a God I had been afraid of. Hence my support for Sunstone Symposia and for BYU professors Wright and even the urgent need to participate. If England had not delivered that talk, and if it had not subsequently been published, I do not know if I would have had the strength to search out reconciliation on my own. If Sunstone did not exist, no other forum would have accepted what he had to say on the matter. The Ensign certainly wouldn't have, and most likely no BYU conference would have allowed him to present the paper. My gratitude to England is mirrored in the experiences of a number of my friends. Many of them claim to owe their membership in the church to BYU professors who, in some way, offered them an example of such reconciliation. Somehow, though, these same professors find themselves on rumored hit lists, in trouble with stake presidents, or, as in Marty Bradley's case, the victim of threats and obscene messages. This phenomena is what has prompted me to finally write this letter. Last fall, I was bothered by a discreet reference to David Knowlton in your address to the faculty. Although you did not mention him by name, I am almost certain you were talking about him. I'm positively certain he was talking about him. He practically quoted his comments to the B.H. Roberts Society. Each time I have spoken with Dave, which encounters have been many over the past few semesters, we end up spending hours in his office talking vigorously about our experiences in the church and our commitment to the gospel. He has wept a number of times while expressing his testimony to me. I didn't know that reading this letter was going to do this to me. I apologize. I consider him a good friend and a fine example of the type of person, the kind of character I wish all BYU faculty were. More recently, I've become aware of a letter you wrote to Cecilia Conchar Farr regarding her Now speech, among other things. I stress that Cecilia was not the person who made me aware of this letter. And perhaps I am reacting to unfair gossip. but I consider my source credible. This bothers me even more than the comments about Dave. My circle of acquaintances includes a number of students who feel marginalized as feminists and as women and at BYU and in the church. I've spent hours on the phone with women friends so frustrated with the status quo that they seriously consider leaving the church once they leave BYU and are no longer forced to obtain ecclesiastical endorsement. I sat last week in a friend's living room and listened to one woman after another, including my wife, recount incidents where each had been seriously abused or violated by a BYU bishop or stake president. Their stories were not told in anger. They were pain-filled confessions. They were told in an attempt at catharsis. I was the only male in the room, and I wept with them, realizing how differently bishops have treated me because I am a man. Many of these women are among those who can find... Thank you. They don't think we're going to do this here. You save it for sacrament meeting. Sacrament meeting, I think they chased me out of the building. Many of these women are among those who can find nothing good enough about the church to keep them in it once they leave BYU. I go out to say that I know many women who say that Cecilia Farr is the only thing that has kept them in the church. In the numerous classes I've had from Cecilia, she's never made bitter comments about the church, never defied its patriarchal organization, never slandered its leaders. Her questions and criticisms, if ever expressed in private, are prefaced by her testimony. I've overheard many BYU students ask her why she stays in the church when many of them feel so much pressure to leave. She explains, as Marty Bradley did at a recent Voice meeting, that she has had a witness of the Spirit. I admire Cecilia for being one so well-versed in theory which should have no mercy on the church's organization, but who still remains active and faithful. Her work with Voices included a temple project encouraging women to research genealogical records and to do temple work for famous women in world history. Considering the number of Mormon feminists, including BYU students, and including my wife for a long time, who would not attend the temple because of difficulties with its doctrinal content, Cecilia should be recognized and praised the way you praise Alan Bergen for his work in psychology. I just finished by telling him how important teachers like Dave and Cecilia are to students like me who have had those kind of marginalizing experiences where we've had to reconcile difficult points of church doctrine, and without examples like them, we might not even have the desire to try to remain in the church. Okay, all right, it's almost, that's all of the letter. It's almost funny now to think that the two professors I felt the need to defend, the two professors I felt had been so unjustly attacked, were the first two to suffer the flames of the Inquisition. A few days later, I received a response from Hafen in which he thanked me for my concern, thanked me for sharing my experiences, with which he said he could identify to a great degree, thanked me for what he perceived as my strength of testimony and my desire to affect BYU in a constructive way, then assured me bluntly and condescendingly that the things I had been hearing about Cecilia Farr were not unusual for someone undergoing the third-year review process. He failed altogether to address the questions I asked about his attacks on David Knowlton, and I felt like the small paragraph I received from Bruce Hafen could hardly do justice to the 5 pages, single space worth of questions that I had sent to him. One of the most disturbing aspects of this incident is that against Dr. Farr's will and without her knowledge, letters from students and faculty antagonistic to her were solicited by members of her college review committee and inserted into her review file mid-process. Provost Hafen's scathing letter was inserted into her review file, but was my letter in her defense inserted, or did it go into Dr. Knowlton's file? Of course not. I was erased. I didn't count. My experience, treated like the 1 in 100 whose hand doesn't burn when she touches the stove, was dismissed as irrelevant, as false evidence. I know that mine is not the only such case. After Cecilia's picture appeared with an article on academic freedom in the New York Times last year, I received at Student Review a letter from a Mormon attorney in California. She had sent carbon copies to Cecilia and to the university administration. She chastised the university administration for the opposition they were posing to Cecilia and others even then. This was prior to the firing. Did this letter end up in Cecilia's file? Of course not. But you can rest assured that every letter scrawled by backwoods provincial church members addressed to the brethren was forwarded promptly and brought to bear against Cecilia and others. I'm not joking. Every letter I saw in response to Marty Bradley's appearance on Take Two was addressed to the brethren, B-R-E-T-H-E-R-N. And these letters are given serious consideration. let me skip over this. Although BYU students who share my views on these subjects certainly aren't a majority of the student population, I've encountered others like me who are just strange enough to need teachers who might be a little strange too. Unfortunately, I encounter more students whose trusting, vulnerable, and impressionable faith has led them to believe in perfect leaders in a mythical perfect system, only to set them up for a hard fall. Following the faculty firings, that sounded like Neil Maxwell. Sorry about that. I didn't realize that when I wrote that, I promise. I received 4 letters from students I didn't know who said their faith had been destroyed as they watched the system operate in the dismissal of Farr and Knowlton. Another letter from a classmate said that BYU had bit by bit stripped away his passion for God, the church, and even for education. BYU and its administrators must realize that the threat to students' faith does not come from asking too many questions or exposing them to a variety of viewpoints. Rather, the faith of all students is jeopardized when the system paints a false portrait of itself, when it hides its secrets, when it acts in devious and underhanded ways instead of being open and honest. Invariably, students I know who have lost faith in the church were given false expectations to measure the church against. They are told that only God's will comes to pass from church and university leaders. They are like the missionaries I knew who were discovering that Brigham Young really did teach everything the anti-Mormons say he did, when they had been raised their whole life to believe that his correlated counsel was complete and exhaustive. I know no students whose faith has been destroyed by association to either David Knowlton or Cecilia Farr. I do know, on the other hand, a number of students who have confided in private that one or the other of them is responsible for keeping them in the church. In fact, the only students I know who have abandoned their faith while at BYU cite the religion class teachings of the living prophets or some similar circumstance as the culprit. To come from a world and a generation where finally we're beginning to see through the facade of white male authority, so-called teachings of the living prophets, although most of the leaders they use in that class are dead, especially as appropriated and assembled by conservative white male professors who stand to lose their own petty authority, find it difficult to fit into our worldview. We can hardly fathom the racism that has existed and continues to exist in the Mormon tradition, or the power structures that privilege male over female and exclude women from decision-making at every level of church government. Although many BYU students feel otherwise, many of us cannot tolerate misogyny, homophobia, and anti-intellectualism, which I think are the 3 main dangers to the church. We can't fit our innate revulsion to these things into a conservative Mormon worldview. And when we are told that something is wrong with us for feeling this way, too many of us see abandoning the faith as our only option. But leaving the church is not an option I feel I have to take. And people like Dave and Cecilia have been key examples of people who struggle with similar issues but who come out on the side of faithfulness to the religion to which we belong. I believe and I will continue to believe, and no imperfect mortal can take that away. I've had experience after experience with God in a Mormon context, and I'm here to stay. One of the most significant moments to me in the recent campus crisis was when a teacher I respect a great deal asked me how my testimony was holding up. He wanted to know if my faith had been shaken, but it's interesting that he showed honest concern for my faith. But how could it have been shaken if it consists only in truth, only in defending the truth? It is this aspect of my Mormon upbringing that requires me to speak out against what I see as abuses of authority, as evidence of hatred that runs counter to the gospel as I understand it. My faith in God, in truth, in honesty is secure. Unfortunately, my faith in people, especially people in authority, has suffered significantly. To conclude where I started, Bruce Hafen was worried that BYU needed to protect my faith. Well, I say to him, if they were worried about my faith in BYU, the only thing they could have done to secure it would have been to act worthy of it. Thanks.
This June, in the wake of the Cecilia Farr David Knowlton firings, I spoke at an academic freedom forum in the Excelsior Hotel about the impact Events in Progress would have, not just upon the professors in question, not just upon the institution, but upon students. I insisted that students would suffer most in the post-firing fallout, that students, entrusting the singular experience of an undergraduate education to BYU... Oh, I'm sorry, thanks. That students... Is it on? Is that okay? Where am I? That students entrusting the singular experience of an undergraduate education to BYU were most betrayed in that trust, that as consumers of education, BYU students had been sold a house of learning, but in reality had purchased a hall of orthodoxy, and now constricted within that narrow purchase had little room for recourse or retribution. Caveat emptor, I warned, buyer beware. For me, as well as for many others in attendance, that assembly was a very emotional experience. It was not some detached philosophical debate on the merits of academic freedom. It was not some show of strength. It was no power play. It was personal. The text and subtext for my speech was my personal experience at Brigham Young University. I entered in the fall of 1989 as a National Merit Scholar and a Benson Scholar, having chosen BYU over Stanford University. Despite the university's resistance to progressive thought, resistance to faculty and student body diversification, resistance even to currency in my field of study, I prepared myself for graduate work at a top-ranking university. However, I found that the BYU label on my transcript spoke more loudly than all my hard work. Imagine my heartbreak when, interviewing for the Western Board of the Mellon Foundation as a finalist for a prestigious fellowship, I spent the bulk of my interview not talking of my own strengths but defending BYU's weaknesses. The board did not believe that a BYU undergraduate could be adequately prepared to compete in a competitive program among a diverse student body. It was a disheartening, demoralizing experience. I'm sure that those who are present on this panel today can share similar horror stories, how inquiry has sometimes been discouraged, how activism has been accused and ostracized, how excellence has been neglected. In addition to these individual anecdotes, I believe that there is evidence of more widespread negative externalities from BYU's academic freedom crisis. I will share three of them here. One, lack of diversity. As BYU faces this identity crisis, university administrators have sought to strengthen the university by focusing its vision, uniting its viewpoints, in non-euphemistic terms, proclaiming orthodoxy. And in the words of Lyotard, consensus and terrorism. BYU is already inhospitable to those who are unorthodox in appearance, and those who are politically or academically unorthodox find themselves labeled, targeted in classes, denied positions, and discounted. And the cost will continue to mount. As unorthodox faculty members are fired and resign, as many are doing in the wake of the Farr-Knowlton incidents, similar unorthodox students will lose mentors, friends and examples, encouragement to continue in novel, uncomfortable, and groundbreaking thinking. The novel thinkers will find this essential productive novelty too expensive. This diversity drain will further bleed our already pale university to an even more milky pallor. I intend the white pun in all of its applications. BYU is shamefully lacking in ethnic diversity in student body and faculty. Competitive graduate and professional programs expect incoming students to be able to function well in very diverse settings. BYU's ostracization of liberal academics will serve further notice to admission boards that BYU graduates are underexposed to difference and will have inadequate levels of tolerance. 2. Patronization. Documents released after the Farr-Knowlton firings reveal among BYU's top administrators attitudes that students are a, quote, captive audience, unquote, children who must be protected from challenge, from hardship, from coming to consciousness. This attitude is not only insulting, it is stultifying. BYU is shamefully lacking in student representation. Other universities with student bodies as capable as BYU's recruit student advisors to comment and vote on departmental and university matters. Such opportunities are very limited at BYU. The lack of advisorial avenues detaches students from control of and thus responsibility for their own educations. A model of academic patronage is enforced, with students as passive receivers of truth from established sources instead of as active searchers. Never being weaned from this model, many of our most talented students never take initiative, never take advantage of research opportunities beyond the syllabus, never even consider advanced study. As an additional side effect of this patronization, activist students who are not permitted access to carefully controlled adversarial channels are made to feel wrong for their concern. Remember, this is a school that forbids petitions, that demands permits for protests, and that videotapes the faces of protesters just in case. 3. Paranoia and exhaustion. At most universities, campus activism does not bear the peculiar cultural stigma it does at BYU, and the costs are not so high. Thus, the work of diversity, reform, and consciousness raising is shared by many, and there are greater support networks, even among the upper echelons of the administration. However, at BYU, students who remain undaunted in the face of patronization, who choose to remain activist and alert, are few. These few must do the work of many, on a campus where there is much work to be done, against great and high-seated resistance. If student activists are to last more than a short season, they must be very measured and very careful. While the lessons one learns by being an unorthodox student at BYU are great, the side effects are tremendous. The first cost is exhaustion. For example, students of multicultural or women's literature have to defend their choice of non-canonical subjects, have to fend off charges of radicalism, have to prove that such study is not adverse to the gospel. They have to write letters to defend the professors who teach these risky subjects. All this before the student even reaches page one of her Toni Morrison novel. And what if the student takes his commitment to multicultural literature beyond the classroom to touch other students? At BYU, there is so much work to be done and so few willing to do it. The same group of 100 students fights all of the battles. The second, even more deleterious, side effect is paranoia. Again, I use the student of multicultural or women's literature as an example. Such literatures tend to address issues of exploitation and abuse, issues which many find uncomfortable, distasteful, or inappropriate. Rumors fly up to departmental heads who, shamefully, usually bow to overprotective parents or reactionary observers rather than siding with their own expert faculty. Students sense in their professors' apprehension. Rumors of spies, some not unfounded, persist. Threats are made to professors. Threats are made to students. The paranoia escalates. Faculty colleagues no longer trust each other, and students, already too aware of the secret machinations of the Honor Code Office, distrust each other as well. Both paranoia and exhaustion divert us from our real purpose: study, learning, cooperation, intelligence, joy. As I stated earlier, these side effects impact BYU's most academically promising students, students who could have chosen other competitive universities but came to BYU. Standout students who were promised the highest caliber education, but instead are instructed in the art of orthodoxy, in the safety of the masses, in the ease of passivity. Every year, with every entering class, the number of standout students increases and the tragedy grows. Everyone knows that it is increasingly difficult to get into BYU. Over the last 5 years, the average entering ACT score has increased from 23 in 1988 to 27 in 1993. Whereas college guidebooks once characterized it as non-competitive in the company of Boise State University, BYU now rates as a highly competitive university with Boston College and Vassar. Has there been a commensurate dynamic at work within the faculty? Has there been a commensurate change in administration regard for students? Except for enhancement of the honors program, which still serves the same concerned minority which always seeks out such affiliation, the university has not upped the ante to match the abilities of its ever-brighter students. And it will not be able to serve these students, nor to prepare them to be capable of competing with the best in their fields, as the university mission statement pledges, unless it renews its commitment to university education. It must follow the examples of high-caliber institutions across the nation in fostering diversity, independent thought, and social responsibility. Certainly, this would require a major change in university orientation. If BYU students are to compete with the best in their fields, they must be conversant in current literatures and philosophies. Thus, subjects of human experience now considered verboten in humanities and social sciences discussions would have to be accepted. Postmodernist schools of thought, now criticized or discouraged in some circles as disrespectful of and dangerous to authority, would have to be taught. It is in the liberal arts and social sciences where much of the reorientation must be done, and certainly those in the humanities and social sciences who have sought to push the envelope have paid great tolls. If this is not the direction the university wishes to take, it can no longer in good faith promise a high-caliber university experience to its incoming students. And perhaps this is a wise path for BYU. Continue solid middle and honorable trades, education, engineering, nursing, but leave the liberal arts institutions more open to discussion and diversity. Advise high-caliber students that other places are better suited to their needs. In this way, students will not be tricked into trading their educational birthright for the proverbial mess of pottage, and one of the greatest tragedies of the academic freedom crisis will be averted. Thank you.
Before beginning, I think I should make something clear about my transfer from BYU to Columbia University. My motivation for transferring was not any kind of response to problems or restrictions I encountered at BYU, but it was simply a decision to add a deeper experience to my life and a new dimension to my university studies. I left BYU without any disdain or bitterness. However, that is not to say that my experience at BYU was easy and untroubled. I did have several experiences at BYU that I would like to share, but I'd like to begin first by describing an informal survey that I conducted this last spring while I was attending Columbia University in New York. I ended up publishing this survey eventually in the Student Review as an article, and it was entitled "What Ivy League Students Know About BYU." And I'd just like to share a couple of questions that I ask. One of my questions read: if you were offered a full scholarship to BYU, including room, board, and books, would you attend? Over 80% of the students responded yes. To my surprise, only 8% responded no, and the rest were undecided. But it was the following question I found just as interesting. Would a mandatory dress and honor code discourage you from attending? This time, 83% responded with a resounding no, or excuse me, yes, and usually accompanied by an emphasizing expletive of some sort. But I was fascinated that over 4 out of 5 Ivy League students would be willing to attend BYU if they were assisted financially. I thought that was very remarkable. The survey, however, revealed to me that at least at the present and among students, the perception of BYU as a viable university has not been extensively tarnished by the academic freedom debate, most likely because it is not well known. However, I see that the largest factor affecting BYU's reputation is perhaps its mandatory dress code that presents the school as an archaic fossil clinging fanatically to 1950s-style dress codes. The university's obsessive concern with maintaining an image of respectability and an all-American sheen fails to meet its goals. The dress code actually casts the school in an image of radical militant conformity. The desired image backfires and makes BYU appear crazier and more radical than if students could wear beards and long hair. I hope this policy will eventually change if both BYU and the church to progress in this new period. Now, I'd like to return now to my experience at BYU. Looking back now after a year's experience at Columbia University. And I want to share just a few experiences that I had within the 2 years at BYU and how they relate to the current debate over academic freedom. In one of my first English classes at Brigham Young University, the professor was leading a lecture about medieval poetry and began to analyze the origins of several words. One of the words being analyzed was a modern expletive. In place of uttering the word shit, the professor spelled it on the chalkboard and gestured to it whenever it was used within his sentence. I don't think that that his fear of speaking the word shit was out of a concern for faculty prohibitions, but I think it was actually a concern for just as intimidating a factor, and that is a very powerful factor, which is student opinion. I also attended another English class where the professor's literary criticism occasionally included analyzing a work by its sexual imagery. I watched as she retracted and altered her discussion when several students began to object to a discussion which included the term phallic symbol. Finally, I watched as a biology professor tiptoed like an embarrassed ballerina through a discussion of evolution, only after offering an extensive disclaimer and an assurance that this was only a man's theory. However, there was good reason for his caution. The same discussion in the past had actually provoked students to leave a banana and an insulting note on the desk of this professor. Interestingly, of all these examples of intellectual discussion that were in different ways reduced to poorer levels of education were not casualties of an institutional policy, but casualties of the fear of an ultra-Puritan student body. In virtually every experience I had at BYU where I felt the quality of the classroom experience was reduced occurred because of an internal student-generated pressure rather than an external institutional squeeze. BYU's largest obstacle in reaching an environment of academic freedom and free inquiry may largely be a stagnant student body entrenched in a Victorian value system and a fear of anything a general authority couldn't say in a talk. The opinion page of the Daily Universe, the campus's newspaper, is frustrating proof of this fact. Now, I am not denying that recent and past effects of institutional policies established by the administration, because those are serious and they do affect the university, but I am proposing that many of these institutional steps may simply be a reflection of the climate generated by a reactionary and obsessive student body. Finally, I came across a quotation from Discourses of Brigham Young that I thought was extremely fitting within this dialogue. You won't be helped but feel the sheer irony of this passage by recalling that the quotation applies to the very university that bears his name. It follows, "I am more afraid that this people have so much confidence in their leaders that they will not inquire for themselves of God whether they are led by him. I am fearful that they settle down to a state of blind self-security, trusting their eternal destiny in the hands of their leaders with a reckless confidence that in itself would thwart the purposes of God in their salvation." Thank you.
I was asked to comment today about how the political climate at BYU affects female students. I can sum the effect up in two words: insulting and demeaning. The atmosphere at BYU is hostile to women, and women are not being allowed to develop intellectually. I can see this in the attitudes of the men and the women in the classes that I teach and in the classes that I take. I've seen women students respond passionately and enthusiastically when allowed to read women novelists for the first time in their English education. I've also seen male students and some female students furious and irate, so upset that the material is about women that they're not even willing to read the material and find out what it says about women or women's issues. But back to the happy students, they're happy because finally they're having the opportunity to write about things that are interesting to them, to have their experiences validated. The atmosphere at BYU tears down women's self-esteem. It teaches them that they are important only in as much as they fulfill the roles of mother and wife, not as actual flesh and blood thinking people with valid thoughts. Women at BYU are suffering from a continual feeling of guilt. We're trying to balance what we should be and what we want to be. And we know that we should be wives and mothers, but we're very interested in our academics and we're trying to be everything to everyone. And I'm really surprised that most of us haven't had nervous breakdowns at this point. There's also a lack of mentoring. We have male professors mentoring male students, promising them the moon. And female students are left to learn on their own. If they want to learn theory, we have to form our own discussion groups and teach it to ourselves. We have no role models. We are governed by a completely male administration. Now, for feminist students, these negative experiences are compounded by several other factors. It has become clear in the past few months that BYU's administration, its board of directors, and many of its professors think that the students are being manipulated by feminist professors. One strain of thought that I've run into repeatedly over the past few months is that feminist professors have manipulated and or dragged their hapless students into irrational frenzies over imagined injustices, and that these frenzies will die down as soon as these professors are gone and the university is purged of their Rasputin-like influences. The assumption that we would not be feminists if it weren't for professors like Cecilia Conchar-Farr, Gail Houston, and Tomian Roberts is insulting. This really shouldn't come as too much of a shock to you, but most of the students whose impressionable little consciousnesses are in danger were raised in the 70s. And we slept in the backseat of our mother's station wagons with Helen Reddy singing I Am Woman over the radio. A lot of us were feminists before we came to BYU, and I don't want to brag, but when I was 11, I wrote a play commemorating Susan B. Anthony in the Seneca Falls Convention, which my classmates and I performed for the entire school. So I was pretty set by the time I got here at 18. The administrators and teachers who purport to be most concerned for our spiritual well-being don't seem to care enough for us to actually sit down and talk to us about why feminism is important to us or to express their concerns to our faces. Certain that they know what is best for us, they make decisions that will have a huge impact on our lives without even knowing who we are. It seems they would rather remain distant and anonymous as they make judgments about the appropriateness of my education, my politics, my learning. Now, if the faculty members are being accused of actively promoting opinions contrary to church doctrine, then what does that say about the students who hold these same opinions? I feel as though I went to bed one night a good Mormon and woke up the next morning as the Antichrist, with the sole purpose, as one letter to the editor put it, of gaining sympathy for a traitorous cause. In my department, I feel, and I am an English major, I feel that feminist students are left to fend for themselves. The department chairs have dismissed students, feminist students' concerns as partisan. So what we say isn't important because we're just groupies. They do not acknowledge feminist theory and criticism as having a very legitimate place in academia. What is ironic is that in my department, the feminist students are the best and brightest. They are the ones who got into good graduate programs, received huge fellowships, have published papers, are attending conferences, are continually asked to be teaching assistants, etc. And yet, when we express a need for classes that will help us get into graduate programs, classes that will help us pursue our interests, which as graduate students, we are supposed to be developing as scholars, we are told you are not a priority in this department. And don't go to the English banquet next year expecting to see a feminist student get Graduate Student of the Year or any department award because it just doesn't happen. As I pursue a PhD in English literature, I'm quickly learning that my professional goals place me in a minority among other Mormon women my age. In conference talks, in sacrament beanie talks, in BYU devotional forums, in Ensign articles, in BYU religion classes, and most especially in our favorite editorial page, The Daily Universe, I am constantly reminded that what I am doing is different, dangerous, and unholy. This used to scare me. But having been told that what I think and believe is wrong so many times, I'm becoming impervious to it. I'm starting to lose faith, not in myself, because my heritage has taught me that my instincts and the answers to my prayers are legitimate, but in the leaders who cannot see past the word feminist to the person I am and to the relationship that I have with my Christ. Early American suffragist Lucretia Mott, Quaker, gave the following speech in the 1800s, and she said, "We have so long been pinning our faith on other people's sleeves that we ought to begin examining these things daily ourselves to see whether they are so." And this has become my mantra. At this point, I'm done trying to please everybody else. I'm done trying to balance my concept of myself and the validity of my goals with the Mormon cultural concept of who I should be and what I should want. I need to focus my energies on my studies, on pursuing my academic interests, not trying to justify them to people who aren't really listening anyway.
I'll introduce my comments today by saying that I was not going to read this. For the time being, the livelihood of myself and my husband and our two children in part depends upon BYU employing me. And I was afraid that I would no longer be employed if I participated in this. I'm not doing this, however, out of a great amount of courage. It's because I didn't have a chance to type it and nobody else can read my handwriting. So be that as it may, I guess I'm making kind of a bold step. I approach this issue much more... As a teacher, I haven't been really a student at BYU for quite a while, in the sense that some of these people have. And since I am taking kind of a chance here, I'd like to begin with the scripture. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And there began the grand conversation, the endless call and response of the rational world. God spoke, and there was light. We call and question to each other and to God, and this is how we know we are alive. This is why we want to be alive, so that we might find some answer, a sensible explanation for this irrational universe. In the spiritual realm, we call this seeking, prayer, meditation, ritual, even testimony. In the scholarly process that we've been handed at the university, it has evolved from a monastic tradition, from a religious tradition, which requires, however, that we take our questions and create from them proclamations and professions. We formalize the conversation at the university. We analyze it. We transcribe it. We make theory out of it, out of these echoes and voices. We're grappling for definitions. We learn to say what is true and not what we feel. Above all else, the pronouncements that we learn to make must be whole and complete and never in flux, at a time when most of us are still in the early stages of spiritual and intellectual evolution. BYU, however, has the glorious possibility of being an institution which reintroduces a sense of questioning. It has the possibility of becoming an institution which avoids the most dangerous manifestations of institutionalized intellectualism, the violent and inaccurate appropriation of truth abstracted from life experience. It can be an institution where we can and should be able to say not just what is true in an academic sense, but what we feel about that truth in a spiritual sense, or how we have, as Gloucester says in King Lear, seen feelingly to arrive at our personal truth. Too often, however, we have a tendency to adopt the more sterile elements of the scholarly tradition, that abstraction of truth, the demand for clean, whole, finished assertions rather than complex and evolving questions. I received a letter from a student not long ago. He's an older student. He's a father, former serviceman, excited to be back in university. He expressed his concern about things that were being said in my class, in class discussion. And he acknowledged that although I had never said anything contrary to church doctrine, that by my silence and body language, I had in fact supported assertions which were contrary to church doctrine. As I talked with him about it later, he said that perhaps I ought to police the class discussions so that the younger students might not be led astray. I expect and hope that my students are assertive and independent thinkers. If they are not, then I expect them to become them. I'm afraid, however, that we are often, as teachers and leaders and policymakers, guilty of infantilizing our students. They can ask questions, they are not foolish, and if they are so easily led astray, not even by bold assertions, but by then our institutional problems are far graver than we've even imagined.
How much time do we have? 15 minutes. So we have about 15 minutes for questions. If I can get this little Oprah Winfrey thing off. If we can, come someplace close enough to the microphone where you can speak your question into it so it gets on the tape, and then we'll run back and forth, and I'll be Phil Donahue or something.
I'll start out with a question because I've thought about this question myself. Somebody mentioned that it was the same 100 students who are fighting the same battles over and over. How much do you think the academic freedom issue and the tension over that has affected general students? I mean, your normal, everyday students who aren't English majors, feminists, multicultural students, aren't activists.
I guess there's the cynic's viewpoint and the idealist. The cynic's viewpoint is probably not much. A lot of people are not all that concerned. And feel that perhaps this is a good move, or that don't appreciate what this will entail. On the other hand, a lot of students who may not agree with David Knowlton and Cecilia Farr did say, why can't the administration be honest about what they're really doing? And so even if they don't agree with the specific feel that the administration needs to be upfront about what their agenda is, and most people that I've spoken to have said, we all know the real reason they're being fired is not academics, but these other issues. And so in that sense, I think there is a sense, an overwhelming sort of undermining of faith in the administration to be honest about its issues. And I think in line with Joanna's paper, whether people are concerned, I think this will have a great effect on people's degrees and their ability to get good jobs and get into programs, depending on the major. And so the effect that it will have on student body, I think more students are sort of realizing that this could have effects beyond whether they agree with specific issues of professors. I'll just stand up here. I think, too, that what we forget is that BYU really is a distillation of the church as a whole, at least it becomes such, and that these issues, although they're centered maybe on a few people at one institution, have a tremendous impact on the church as a whole and how we begin to evolve as a church socially and how we begin to treat people also.
Someone else? Well, I feel like a deacon.
Wow.
The only thing I think about that is that... Is that a lot of the letters to the editor of the Daily Universe following the protest that most of us, Farrell was still in New York, but the rest of us were involved in the protest. A lot of people said that we were just pouting like babies who didn't get what they want and things like that. A lot of people seem to say that if the administration says it, which is an interesting thing, if the administration says it, then it is God's word and God's opinion. So the administration's been moved up to the level of general authority or something.
I really agree that we have a problem with a student body. I also am a graduate student and teach.
This is more of a comment than a question, but it's also in response to BJ. I don't know. But I think that there is a problem with the student body, as you pointed out. I just was explaining to some people that I felt like I had some tacit threats made by a student. Because I suggested that we should not spout off about feminism or Marxism or other thoughts until we were well-read in those areas. And somebody said, well, as long as you give me an A in the class, I won't write to Rex Lee. And so we do have that problem. But I do think this affects more than 100 of the students that are protesting. This affects students because we're not allowed to let them learn to think critically and to read critically, or because, I mean, they're just blind obedience and blind faith will not lead to mature faith. And I think Paul Descano said yesterday, we have to go through the chaos to really start understanding things. And when we are certain, we lose compassion. And I think I think this affects a lot of students because they are not taught to think and read critically. And so it affects much more than 100 students. Sorry, but I just had to...
There's a question right here. If you can just say it and I'll repeat it into the mic.
I may be somewhat of a rhetorical question. Yeah, but we're going to lose our testimony.
The question basically is, what has happened in the church that leaders would be so scared that members would lose the testimony? We better pray about it and ask for an answer.
This won't be a definitive answer, of course, but I read an article in Network discussing Dr. Farr's firing, and what it meant, it was an interesting comment that said that BYU is experiencing in the last couple of years the sort of feminist activism that was going on in the 70s at most other universities. And that might be part of it. I think there might be a fear of feminism really taking root, and the kind of activism that went on at the universities was really transformative, and there may be a fear that that's going to go on here. You've got activists who are willing to go public, who are willing to go and march, of all things, and be involved in many areas, and it might be part of a feminist backlash. I think that's an aspect of it. I think there's a fear of women getting too uppity, and so... I can't comment.
I have a question. I have a response.
That's an interesting experience I had. The comment was made that it's because BYU is a showcase for the church. An interesting experience I had in a class. I was in a class that in which the teacher is also an instructor of environmental biology, and he told us that in his environmental biology class, the students were very concerned that BYU's landscaping was always so tame and so well-groomed and shaped, and everything was perfect. And they said, why can't we have any wilderness and just let flowers grow someplace? So they called in the head of BYU grounds crew and asked him to explain the situation to their class. And he told them that it was that the grounds crew was under very explicit instructions from the leaders of the church to have it so well-groomed because they wanted the landscape to reflect the type of students and the type of faculty that they wanted at the university, well groomed and tamed and everything else too. But true story. Jay.
Thank you. First of all, I think that your portrayals of the situation at BYU have been very fair. I wonder, Brian's kind of shown us how effective letter writing can be with BYU's current administration. I'm wondering what you think needs to be or can be done to bring about this change, and also what form you think this kind of change might take.
The comment was go away and come back in 10 years. I heard that out there from a familiar voice.
I think they need a new board of trustees.
The comment was made that a new board of trustees might be a solution, which it's probably not a bad solution to, in some way or another, to separate ecclesiastical authority from administrative authority, and that way you don't have every little decision that's made by the university carry the authority of God's sanction. You know, I don't think God cares whether or not I shave in the morning. I don't think he cares if I wear shorts to class that are a little bit above my knee, and I don't think he cares if my hair gets as long as it doesn't touch my collar, I'm safe. But as soon as it touches my collar, I mean, my salvation's in jeopardy.
Well, because I don't think that, I don't have a lot of faith that we are going to get a new board of trustees, I really have to agree with what Joanna said at the thing at the Excelsior shortly after the firings, and that is intelligent young women need to not come to BYU, and those of us that are here need to leave because we're tired, we're depressed, we're discouraged, and we're losing faith in ourselves and our abilities. And at this point, I don't think there's anything... this soldier is tired of fighting.
I was going to say, it's a difficult question because you don't want to be cynical and lose heart. One of my friends we were discussing this panel with said, it feels like a hostage situation. And you're there for a while and you're able to keep fighting. But after a while, of all of the disapproval and veiled threats, it gets really exhausting and you want other people to take the thing. And anything you do is taken as a hostile act to the university. And so I don't think there's been a good question of what can be done to transform it in the current model.
I just want to respond a bit to some of the comments and just kind of offer my own perception. There is, in fact, speaking of the landscape, there is in fact a wild side to BYU. There's a corner down by the Mazur building where they actually let things grow wild. And as a former editor of Student Review, I wrote an essay on editor's comment on that, and how I really like, that's one of my favorite places to walk down in the paths there, because there is a wild side, and there are things that aren't entirely tamed and controlled. And here we've got a group of students that are willing to say something different and who still are a part of that community. And I guess my desire, it's been 3 years since I've been at BYU, graduated and went on, I'm a candidate in anthropology at University of Pennsylvania, and BYU has potential, and there's a lot there, and I'm a little bit dissatisfied to hear the dismay and to hear people wanting to give up, because it's a big place, it's not going to go away, and there's a hell of a lot of people out there who are going to keep coming. And those people are going to, in the process of learning, encounter new ideas and be able to find the wild side and find that there are different voices out there. There are some of us who came prepared with agendas before and had ideas, but there were a lot, like myself, who discovered these ideas and discovered new perspectives while at BYU. And I think it's a place that my greatest fear over this crisis is that in talking over the last weeks with some of my former faculty and friends there, that people are feeling dissatisfied and wanting to give up. And I'm afraid if we do that, there will be a greater loss.
I really feel I ought to leave the microphone to the students. It somehow wandered into my hands, however. I just want to say a few things. I think one of the most glorious things to have happened at BYU in recent memory is the students standing up and speaking out for themselves, by themselves, without anyone motivating them, anyone moving them. If there's one thing that really looks well for the future at BYU, it's students taking their education into their own hands. BYU is really an incredible place. Yes, it's a place that's torn. It's a place that in many ways is at war with itself. But it still is an incredible place. BYU has one of the best and the brightest student bodies I've ever seen in my life. It has a student body that's committed to the gospel. That's committed to the gospel using ideas of every origin and of every type to understand the gospel and to manifest the gospel. I think BYU's heritage of trying to maintain reason and faith is marvelous. And I think this panel is actually an example of that. If you look to see how they've used the language, stretched the tradition of Mormonism to encompass a wide variety, I think that bodes well for the faith. I think it's great that we now have disagreements, that we have differences of opinion. It makes BYU more like other universities, but it also gives us strength. There is strength in diversity, as long as we can remember our unity as well. And I don't really want to say much other than just to really congratulate these people here for standing up, for speaking. And there may be only 100 who are out there, but I've spoken to at least 100 more, if not a lot more than that, who've come to my office to speak, who stand with these young people, who support them. And one other quick comment, the impact on other students, I just wish everybody could sit in faculty offices and listen to students' struggles. Pablum doesn't work. Platitudes don't work when people are confronted with hard questions of faith. Honesty, candor does. If there are troubles in history, let's be honest. If there are difficulties of intellectual thought, let's be honest. People generally appreciate that. And that's been my experience, but I guarantee you the impact here is yet to really be felt by or be expressed by the multitudes of students who are coming back in about 2 weeks and will begin to express their feelings on the issue.
Yeah. It's easy for students at BYU like you to feel alone, and I just want to tell you of just how many people there are all across the country who are cheering what you've been doing, and as you can see in this room today. But if you can keep that in your mind's eye and realize that some important hopes of Mormonism rest on efforts like yours realize that you carry something more important than just your own well-being.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment that there are other universities out there, and yes, we can try to change BYU, but you can also choose to go to another university.
Yeah, there's something that's puzzling me, and maybe you can help me figure it out. It seems that BYU claims that much of the action they take, the disciplinary action they take, is because of the students come and complain. Okay, and when I went to University of California, I remember if I had gone into the provost or department head and complained and said, oh, I'm sorry, the teacher said shit in class, what can we do about it? Or, you know, they're teaching evolution, what can we do about it? They would have kicked me out. I mean, he would have kicked me out of his office and said, don't waste my time, or go talk to the professor if you've got a disagreement with it, or write a paper. Why is there this mechanism at BYU that allows this sort of thing? I mean, it seems like it should be done away with.
Farrell said, and I'll answer the question, then pass it on very quickly. We are out of time, so we'll try to wrap it up before the 3:30 session starts. I think Farrell said it's because letters from the parents, and I think what the letters from the parents indicates is that it's letters from tithe payers. And Paul Richards, who is BYU's former spokesperson, spoke last year at Sunstone about how BYU has a worldwide board of trustees. Because all these people who pay their tithing think that because they pay their tithing, they can write a letter into the university and dictate what goes on. And I know people in the anthropology department. I know of a specific example there. I know of examples in the English department where something was deemed offensive. A student told their parent. The parent wrote a letter to the board of trustees. The board passed it to Rex Lee. Rex Lee passed it to their department. It goes all the way around. But the main thing is people are afraid of losing tithing. I mean, you get that fear. But what my answer is I pay tithing too. And I have since I was old enough to be socialized that I had to pay a penny off of every dime. And if it's my tithing too, and I think there are enough other people who may feel the same way, we can write letters and say, it's our tithing, and I don't want my tithing going to an institution that's going to stifle that kind of inquiry that can produce real testimonies in people, not just hollow fake ones. So if all of you agree and you all pay your tithing, then send your part of the Worldwide Board of Trustees, and you can send your letters too.
That prompts me to ask, since when has the church ever extended voting rights with our tithing? We'd be better off if they did. As a former BYU student who was invited to leave over 10 years ago, I have to say that I am one of the most avid supporters of student review, and it is my faith for BYU's future. It restores my faith in BYU. It keeps my faith in BYU, just as Sunstone keeps my faith in the church membership in general. And I am concerned because a student population is a transient one. And when you talk about only 100 students that are carrying on this fight, all 100 will likely graduate within 4 years. Well, at least 80% of them will, and some in maybe 10 years. But is there another, you know, is this going to continue when this 100 that is there now and fighting this fight graduates? Is this perpetuating itself, or is it going to die? Is it going to be snuffed out by the reactionary Board of Trustees? What's the prognosis for the future?
Farrell's answer is absolutely not. Because they're like student reviews existed for 8 years, and I've had people say, how in the world, you know, I heard Kurt Bench told me the other day, when this thing first came out, I thought it'd last a couple issues. But it's gone for 8 years, which means we keep turning it over to someone who's interested enough to keep putting out this newspaper that doesn't have any support from the campus. At the same time, when Joanna Brooks did research after the original firing, she found out that with every year, as these ACT scores go up and up and up, there's another phenomenon happening, and that is the number of top students who are offered the Benson scholarships, the number of students who decline that scholarship, which is a full-ride scholarship to BYU, is also increasing, which means that the top potential students at BYU is going down while the general academic level is going up, which means there are top students who are choosing not to come to BYU, and it's probably for reasons associated to this. Farrell's mom said stop, but I think we'll take one more, and then this is it. This is the last one.
I'm a current student at BYU. Just to be fair, I have an instructor. I heard him say fuck 7 times in one class period. Also, I have started postmodernism. I just wrote an essay on it, and I've sat in a class, and we had a panel of homosexuals come, and we've discussed things. I really agree with the statement that the student carves out his own education, or makes his own education and experience at BYU. I have to admit, I came to this, I hope you don't think I'm being antagonistic, but I came to this expecting to be antagonistic, and I've been really impressed with what I've heard. I think it's an excellent observation that you made, that the problem is the student body. I found that when the student body was, when the students in a classroom were willing to talk about things, we've had as open a discussion as I could have hoped for. But when students are not, I felt stifled, not by the teacher but by students in the classroom. And I think the perception is that they're scared of you. I'm talking to a student review members because they think that you represent something that I don't think you really do. And that's something that I'm arriving at from hearing you speak today. They come to BYU because they're tired of all that. They've been raised for a large part. I was never maybe more than two Mormons in a school where I was raised, I was my whole life hearing, you know, criticism of the church, and you come to BYU and you're so tired of that, you just say, I just don't want to hear it, you know. And that's not, because I think that they are perceiving what you're saying in the student review as maybe it's not, I think I'm starting to believe it's not really that what it's perceived to be. And I would just feel like that the change can be made if we can change the students' minds. And I'd say that if you were going to make a change in the student review, make it so you direct your what you're writing more to the students and be persuasive to the students. Because I'd love to see that. I mean, because people read it like because they think it's like the Inquirer. It's this. They want to see what ungodly thing the student review is going to say this week, so they can just be totally morally outraged by it. And I think if you will be convincing enough to not give them that, you know, to make them read that paper, that's and say, you know, they have a point here, and that's the first time I'm finding myself in line with these people, I think that it'll be a lot more effective.
That's right. Okay, here we go. One more comment, and then we'll drop it. I just didn't want to reduce this discussion and blame it all on the students. There is an enormous problem with the administration of BYU. I didn't want to reduce that discussion here by what my comments today.
The fact that the faculty and the administrators encourage students and give them that power, that these little return missionaries feel like they can hassle a 115 teacher and hold power trips over their head because there's an administrator who won't say, get a life, go do your homework, and pass the class on your own. Stop complaining. If they wouldn't listen to the students and pamper them, then they wouldn't act that way.
Right. Okay, my suggestion is, and the invitation I'll close with, write it in an article and I will publish it in the student review. I'm honest. Tell...
Sure.